Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to badlandsranch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 today.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome to the Time of Monsters podcast, sponsored by The Nation magazine. We're in a very busy news cycle, both with the election, but also the continuing conflict between Israel and its neighbors. And those neighbors are not just in Gaza and the West Bank, but also increasingly in neighboring countries such as Lebanon, where there's already a sort of second front, which is expanding. To talk about all this, I'm very happy to have Trita Parsi, Executive Vice President of the Quincy Institute. And I just want to start out with basically, like, there's been a lot of news happening. There's actually a lot of news even today. We're recording on Friday. That's happening today. What exactly is the situation that's unfolding this week?
I think it's fair to say that the situation that is unfolding is the one that Biden could have prevented. But given the strategy that he chose, it is highly predictable that we would end up in this situation at some point, which is that the Israelis expand the war into Lebanon. They are hoping to drag the Iranians into it. And by dragging the Iranians into it, they're hoping that they will achieve their ultimate objective, which is to drag the U.S. into the war and have the United States take on Iran and establish a balance in the region that is far more favorable to Israel by essentially having the United States do the fighting for it, because obviously the U.S. has far greater capabilities than Israel has, particularly in terms of beating back Hezbollah and Iran in a manner that would be satisfactory to the Israelis. As you recall, in 2006, when the Israelis did fight Hezbollah, Israel essentially lost. And the United States were actually, under the Bush administration, quite disappointed in the performance of the Israeli military. Now you can imagine what that would do then vis-a-vis Iran, which obviously is much more powerful than Hezbollah, but also Hezbollah is much more powerful today than it was in 2006. I think we should not be carried away by the technological effectiveness and creativity that the Israelis have used in what I would nevertheless describe as an act of terror. But I think there's a bit of a tendency in Washington to look at some of the technological capabilities of Israel and think that is the determinant as to whether they would win this war or not. If that is the case, then why are they trying to drag the U.S. into the war?
Yeah, no, I mean, that's a great overview. And I would underscore the point, this has been a longstanding ambition of Benjamin Netanyahu to have, you know, like a final reckoning with Iran and to have the United States involved with that. And, you know, I think, like, for obvious reasons, I don't think this is in the national security interest of the United States. You know, coming out of the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, there's a lot of war weariness in the United States. And, you know, you kind of have people on both major political parties who are, you know, reluctant to expend American blood, especially in the Middle East. And even this week, before the recent, you know, the bombing campaign with the pagers and the walkie-talkies, just the day before that happened, an American envoy was in Israel trying to dissuade them from expanding the war. So what does that say about is it fair to say, like, it's not an American desire to have this expanded trade war? And what does it say that they were Israel was so cavalierly willing to dismiss what Biden's own envoy said?
And let's also be very clear. The Biden team has been saying since October 7th that they are worried that Israel is going to try to expand the war into Lebanon and that they are opposed to it. They also credit themselves, saying that had it not been for Biden's pressure, Israel would have already started a war with Lebanon around October 20th when it went into Gaza, and that this is actually because of Biden's pressure that Israel didn't start a two-front war right away. But so we have consistently heard from the Biden administration that they don't want to see an expansion into Lebanon. And we have consistently seen that the Israelis are escalating matters, not just with Hezbollah, but also with Iran. We saw, for instance, the attack against the embassy or the consulate section of the embassy in Damascus. We saw the assassination of Haniyeh. We've seen assassinations of very large scale in Lebanon. Just a day before the attacks by Israel with the walkie-talkies and the beepers, the Biden envoy was in Lebanon and in Israel, actually was in Israel and urging them not to do this. The week before, the Israeli defense minister had said that Israel has to go to war with Lebanon in order to calm down the northern border. We're seeing clearly the Israelis are not listening to the Biden administration. And we have to ask ourselves, not why are they not, but rather, why should they? What consequence has Biden imposed on Israel, not just in the last 11 months, but throughout his entire career, when he has been in a decision-making position, that would cause the Israelis to think, we better think twice about this. We better respect American wishes, particularly when we're fighting almost exclusively with American weaponry and that the Biden administration is providing all of these weapons. Well, because he's not imposed any consequences and instead has pursued the bear hug strategy, a strategy that essentially says that for the United States to have leverage over Israel, it should support it to the tilt, never criticize it publicly, protect it at the UN diplomatically and politically, and even when the Israelis assassinate American protesters, peaceful American protesters, the United States should go forward and make excuses for Israel in order to exonerate it. That apparently magically would have created leverage with Israel and would have caused them to listen to the United States according to the Biden logic. And incidentally, this is a logic that both Republican and Democratic administrations have used before. The only one who didn't was actually Obama, not necessarily on Israel-Palestine, but more so on the Iran file. And guess what? It was Obama's strategy that worked, and Biden's strategy is an abysmal failure. In fact, not only has it not succeeded in preventing the Israelis, it seems like it has encouraged the Israelis to do far more than they may have otherwise have done. And what is fascinating here is that the Biden team came in thinking that the Obama team had mishandled the Israel file. And that had it been the Biden team and their logic, the United States would not only have managed to get the JCPOA, but it would have done so better, would have gotten a better deal. There wouldn't have been any tensions with Israel. This is pure fantasy. Had you pursued the Biden strategy with Israel over the JCPOA, there would never have been a JCPOA in the first place. In fact, the U.S. would probably have ended up going to war with Iran. That's the outcome of pursuing this strategy. And we're watching it live right now. We're seeing how the Israelis are repeatedly humiliating the American president and the American president happily being humiliated.
Yeah, no, I think that, that is the sort of scenario that's been unfolding. If we to step back a little bit, the sort of logic of Biden's position, if one wants to explain it in its own terms, is that the priority should be the sort of cementing of an alliance between Israel and Saudi Arabia, that this is a form of offshoring. It will allow these countries, if they're strengthened by American arms in a very tight defense alliance against Iran, the United States can pay less attention to the Middle East and can pay more attention to its main concerns, which is this great power rivalry that they see as inevitable with Russia and China. And to pursue this, it's worth making any sacrifice to keep Israel and Saudi Arabia happy. Now, there's a recent development which I think sort of shows the, on its own terms, the sort of flaw in this strategy, which is that the Crown Prince, who has been, Saudi Arabia, who's been happily willing to go along with the sort of Abraham Accords, actually clarified, his position, which is that there will be no normalization of relationships with Israel until there is a Palestinian state, not a peace process, a Palestinian state with East Jerusalem as the capital. And to me, like, that illustrates that even Saudi Arabia, very tight American dependency of ally, even Saudi Arabia Yeah, you know, which I would say the Saudi ruling class, particularly the Crown Prince, are not particularly concerned about the Palestinians on a, you know, human level. But even Saudi Arabia has a red line. And so, like, doesn't that show the sort of contradictions of Biden's foreign policy that on its own terms, it can't work?
I think absolutely. Let me just start off with, you know, this logic that they are presenting, saying essentially that this is offshoring. If they're offshoring it, why are we then offering Saudi Arabia security guarantee? We're actually saying that if they end up in war, we'll go on to war on their behalf. What mm-hmm. kind of offshoring is that?
Yeah.
I mean, this is so absurd. This is Trump-level lying, to be frank with you. Say, calling this offshoring when in reality, we're offering them something we've never offered any other country in the Middle East, save Turkey because they're part of NATO, Japan, South Korea, NATO-level security guarantee. And then we're calling that offshoring. It's just absolutely absurd. Mm. But also on the point that you raised, now, I am a little bit skeptical of MBS in the sense that I do think he says these things as part of a bargaining chip, but that when push comes to shove, he will happy sign on as long as he gets the nuclear fuel cycle and the security guarantees and more weapons. And he will make some claim that in some small neighborhood somewhere in the West Bank, a Palestinian state has been established. And he'll go with something like that.
Yeah. You know, one shouldn't underestimate the cynicism of MBS.
But at the same time, he's definitely pouring a lot of cold water of this for the time being. And I think some folks in the Biden administration may have finally come to the conclusion that they will likely not be able to secure this deal, because now they're also coming to the realization that they're not going to have a ceasefire during his presidency. They actually thought that they were going to have one by the end of September for reasons that are still mysterious to me. What I am more worried about at this point is not necessarily that Biden will secure this. Let me explain why I think this would be a disaster. This would be an absolute disaster because of almost every reason that they say it would be good. First of all, we're offering the Saudis nuclear fuel cycle, enrichment technology, something we have not offered any country, and we've gone to great lengths for more than 50, 60 years to prevent that technology from spreading. Mm-hmm. We almost went to war with Iran. We sanctioned them for 30, 40 years over this issue. And now we're going to give it to the Saudis. We also do not trust the Saudis, so we have toyed with contingency plans, one being that we would actually have American military personnel stationed at the nuclear facility in order to prevent the Saudis from taking it over. The other one is that we actually would have explosions. We would have, we would have bombs available at the facility, and we would cause it to explode through remote control if the Saudis managed to take over. If we actually have to have contingency plans of that kind, doesn't that tell us right this is an insane idea?
I think listeners should also, I mean, just like think about it at a basic level. Like, you know, like, is it in America's national security interest for Saudi Arabia to be a nuclear power? And as you mentioned, I mean, like, declare, you know, like, just to spell it out, not only like, you know, the issue of like, you know, do we want the government of Saudi Arabia to have this, but also that this is a total betrayal of basically American non-proliferation strategy going back like many decades across, you know, all administrations. It is actually an open license for like a huge acceleration of nuclear proliferation.
Absolutely. And incidentally, as much as some elements in Israel want this deal, this is the part of the deal that they're most skeptical about.
Yeah.
Because they understand very well that this will enable the Saudis down the road to actually become a nuclear weapon state.
Yeah. No. I mean, it seems...
We walked out of the Iran deal that actually had much stricter restrictions on it than this one does. Yeah. So how do we expect that we will be able to revive that deal if we're actually granting the Saudis the technology that they don't have with restrictions, minus the restrictions that we are hoping that the Iranians would agree to? So that's on that front. Then on the security guarantee front, the idea that we would send Americans to go and kill and die for the House of Saud, the Saudi dictator, would not only drag us deeper into the region. This is the opposite of offshoring. But also we have seen clear patterns that when MBS believes that he has that type of a guarantee from the United States, he's actually acted very recklessly. Invaded Yemen and all of these different things, kidnapped the Lebanese prime minister, killed Khashoggi, imposed an embargo on Qatar, etc., etc. All of that has stopped. And that is not incidentally unrelated to the fact that once Trump showed the signs that he's not going to go to war on their behalf, they suddenly realized that they have to be much more cautious because they don't have a blank check from the United States, unlike the Israelis. And we see how that has affected Israel's behavior. But also on the Palestinian file, what we're essentially saying is Forget the Palestinians. 30, 40 years of telling them, hey, you'll get your state if you go through a peaceful path and you negotiate, has been a complete disaster for them. And instead of fixing that, we're saying, you know what? You're right. It's been a disaster and you don't deserve it. So we're just going to shove you down under the rug and we are going to go and normalize these relations and completely give up the leverage that normalization has for the establishment of a state. So we published a paper just a couple of weeks ago by Jeremy Pressman, Professor Pressman, on what the impact of this has been. And it's absolutely clear. Not only is this not helpful for the establishment of a Palestinian state, this is actually directly unhelpful and undermines the prospect, which then in turn means it increases the likelihood of violence. So we're actually sowing the seeds for further violence between Israel and Palestine.
Yeah, no, I think that makes total sense. I mean, to give the sort of rationale that I think is operating in Washington and also in Saudi Arabia and Israel, I think that the thinking is you can actually shunt the Palestinian statehood question aside if you make some sort of like economic arrangement to, you know, improve the quality of life in the West Bank and Gaza, which seems like, first of all, that's totally contradicted by what we're seeing now, which is like, you know, total devastation of especially Gaza, but also like increasingly in the West Bank, you know, just the life is increasingly difficult. So, I mean, the idea that the Palestinians would ever go for that seems a bit dicey. And again, the central contradiction, which I think you're pointing out here, is this, you know, like the dream is offshoring, that, you know, the United States wants to, you know, the fabled pivot to Asia, which Washington policymakers have dreamed about for like at least the last 20 years or more, can be made possible if we have the security arrangement. But we're actually seeing in practice is like a much greater entanglement with the Middle East. I mean, we're not seeing like, it's not like, you know, the Middle East has disappeared from like the headlines or from like Washington's concerns. It remains on the top of the agenda. So you know, like on its own terms, it seems like a clearly failed policy. And I guess the question I always have is like, you know, like at what point do the policymakers wake up and realize that we've tried, we keep doing the same thing and we keep getting the results that we don't want? Like we have to shift policy somehow. Like, is there any indication that there can be that sort of awakening?
I don't think there will be much of an awakening unless there is a significant uproar from the American public on this issue. Mm-hmm. Because the incentive structure in Washington is such that it is truly seen and believed to be a massive political win to secure this deal, regardless of what the consequences are in the region. And I think they're delusional about those consequences. I mean, if you can't see those consequences right now, then, you know, I'm not convinced that you have the capacity to see them. And keep in mind, Biden himself said at one point, I think it was in November of last year, that Hamas did this because I was on the verge of establishing peace in the region. So he was referring to the Israel-Saudi deal, and he thought that that would cause peace throughout the region, and that Hamas did October 7th to stop Biden from establishing peace in the region. There may be an element of truth that Hamas did this in response to the Abraham Accord, because the Abraham Accord, which Biden was building off of, was shoving the Palestinians under the rug, and it showed that diplomacy didn't work and that negotiations were a mirage and that the Palestinians had to go another path for this. But the idea that he believed that he actually was on the verge of establishing peace in the region tells you that the level of delusion. Here's what I'm worried about. I'm worried about that if Kamala Harris wins, she does not have an extensive record on foreign policy. She's going to come in. She's going to have one opportunity, which is to actually go and renew the JCPOA, because you have an Iranian government now that is sending daily signals that they want to have negotiations with the U.S. on that. Or you can take this deal that is now 95% ready, at least the U.S.-Saudi elements of it, massive concessions to the Saudis, but nevertheless something that can be sold as a win to Washington because there's going to be normalization. And I fear that she will go for it precisely because it would give her a very quick win in the D.C. circuit, and it would enable her to say, look what a foreign policy president I am. So something that would be disastrous for the region, which I think actually some of her advisors recognize, but would be a huge political win in Washington, she may go for, because it would be a quick, easy win for her and something that she may feel that she needs.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that is worrisome. Although what you mentioned about the advisors, I think is a kind of important point. Like unfortunately, I think Harris is running a kind of blank slate campaign, a sort of feel good campaign of, you know, like I'm not good. I'm younger than Biden and younger than Trump, and there's not a lot of policy substance. So the American people are being asked to vote for something that they don't actually know what it's actually going to be. So people are reading the tea leaves by looking at, well, who are her advisors? And there are people around her staff who seem like, you know, much closer to Obama on like making a deal with Iran than they are to like Biden, who seem like much more open to the diplomatic option. But we don't know. I mean, you're right that it's not just advisors, it's also the incentive structure. And towards that end, I mean, in some ways, I think one of the consequences of what we're seeing now is that it gives a shot in the arm to the sort of status quo, because they can sell this narrative again that Israel is very competent, they're a great ally, they're like well in advance, they're doing these incredibly innovative things, like, you know, like blowing up pagers and walkie-talkies, and this can help refurbish the image of, you know, both Mossad and the IDF at a period where, like, I have to think people are like looking at, like, you know, what's happening in Gaza and thinking, like, you know, like, why do we even have this ally that, like, you know, is like so clearly an undisciplined army and so clearly
undisciplined,
you know,
army, genocidal.
Yeah.
On top of that, I think there is an entire generation of Americans now, or a segment, an important segment of it, whose view of Israel is now dramatically different as a result of what they're seeing on their own phones, in which they do view Israel increasingly as an apartheid state that is committing a genocide while at the same time being a threat to American democracy. Because if you are objecting to their genocide, you will be accused of being anti-Semitic, including by the President of the United States.
Yeah.
Now, we can look at it and say, oh, these are just a bunch of idealistic students, but these are students at Harvard, MIT, Columbia, some of the elite schools of the United States. Reality is many of them are going to be the future elite of this country. And this has been a formative experience for them. So there may be some folks in the current DC establishment that looks at this and says, oh, Israel is innovative. And as a result, it has proven its utility to the United States. Mm-hmm. I think that is a view that is not held by large sections of the American public outside of DC. And I think it's the opposite view that will be held by a lot of people that will be forming the future American elite.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. Although I'm just looking at the sort of media coverage and, you know, like, I mean, I try not to be shocked by these things, but it was shocking to me that, you know, these bombings, which, like, you know, killed a lot of civilians, which are like almost like sort of classic terrorist tactic of, you know, like everyday objects being booby trapped and maiming people, that this was treated like just on the level of gadgetry. Like, wow, this is like, you know, it's the old startup nation narrative. Like, the Israelis have a technological edge. And like, it's like, well, you know, like, is that really, you know, like the main lesson you're going to draw from this? Or is it that this is, I mean, like, to me, and, you know, you're more of an expert on this, but to me, it seems like almost a dangerous escalation just in terms of like the type of warfare you're willing to conduct. And like, I think it's like naive to think that like only Israel will be able to do this. Like, you know, like you're opening the door for many other actors to start using, like, you know, like cell phones and radios as, you know, everyday appliances as weapons of war.
Absolutely. And let's just be very, very frank. If anyone else had done this to Israel or to the United States, mm-hmm. there would have been no doubt in Washington. We would have called it an act of terror and an act of war. We don't do neither right now. But the rest of the world, I do think, views it as such. And what we're seeing Israel do in Lebanon today, I think, is just very clear. They have now started a war, clearly against American wishes, but with a president that essentially has chosen to be a lame duck president already since October 2023.
Yeah.
There is absolutely no reason for the Israelis to take Biden seriously. I'm not saying there's any reason for them to necessarily take Harris or Trump seriously at this point either because of the election season. But this is a free-for-all for them right now. And they're using it to expand the war and to drag the United States into that war. And that should raise some very serious questions in the United States, amongst the American public, of what type of a relationship we have with Israel, if this is what this country does to the United States. Because a war with Iran and Hezbollah is not going to be a simple war in any way, shape, or form for the United States.
I think there's two components to this. One is like Biden himself, you know, when something you and I have discussed and other people have discussed, you know, Biden's longstanding ultra-Zionism and loyalties. And, you know, like I think historians will look back and it's also perhaps a little bit of an ineffectual president because of cognitive reasons or a president that's beholden to his staff. So there's the Biden component, but there's also the component of the sort of bipartisan foreign policy elite. Now, Biden's going to be president until January 21st of next year. Harris or Trump will be the successor. But there's that bipartisan foreign policy elite, which is like, you know, committed to the overall structure. But within that bipartisan foreign policy elite, is there any opening for at least like even like a moderate shift of like trying to hold Israel accountable in any way, or really trying to be much more restraining?
I think there certainly is, because at the same time, you know, as horrific as this war has been, and as horrific as it has been to watch Biden just ship weapons after weapons after weapons to Israel, despite himself saying that they're using it indiscriminately, despite them fudging over State Department reports that show that it is actually illegal for the United States to provide these weapons according to U.S. law itself. Despite all of this, we are at this point in a situation in which for the first time there are resolutions and bills introduced in Congress to actually boycott weapon sales to Israel. They're not winning at this point, but they're being introduced. This was completely unthinkable a year ago, that a bill of that kind either even could be introduced. So I do think you're seeing the landscape on this issue changing. It's unfortunately not changing fast enough, but it's changing in deep ways that I think a year ago, a year and a half ago, very few people would even think would be possible.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very nice, hopeful note to end on. I want to thank Trina Parsi once again, both for being on the podcast, but also the excellent work that the Quincy Institute does. I'll link to it. It's a real powerhouse in terms of innovative thinking for getting out of the many foreign policy morasses that the United States has caught in. So thank you for being on the program.
Thank you so much for having me.